Everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Constructive Criticism. I'm your host, Spencer, and I'm joined by a current host of mine, Mason Clark.
That's the highest praise anyone's ever got when the podcast started, right there.
That's probably not true. I think I've called Michael a future Platinum Pro at least 7 times.
That's true, and Finkel was on an episode, so he probably got higher praise than that. But top three, easy.
I mean, I think that PB's been on 2 episodes, Alexander Haynes been on an episode. Like, there's no way that that's even top 10.
Top 25.
That's
my final
true.
Offer.
That's
Take
probably
it or leave
true.
It.
I think that's fair. I think that you probably got a top 25 intro right there. But you know who's always top 25 is our sponsor, Oasis Games. You can check them out at mtgoasis.com. You can get 15% off of your first order by using the code CCMTG at checkout. And you can get 4% off of every order by using the code WouldThatBeGood. Oasis Games is an amazing place for Magic cards. If they don't have what you need, maybe you're looking for sealed product, don't forget to check out Fusion Gaming, because our other sponsor is the Mana Base. They're sponsored by Fusion Gaming. The Mana Base is the place where you can check out Nikachu the Mason Slayer. We really appreciate their sponsorship. They're actually in contact with us to do a couple of other sponsorships. We really, really appreciate them. And, you know, you gotta make your U.S. dollar go far with those Canadian sponsors, man.
It's absurd. Like, you know, I was joking, I think it was to you about this, maybe it was Caroline, but honestly, because of the deals at Oasis and Fusion and everything, it literally like paid for my GP Vegas trip. Like the money I get to save from all that stuff is insane.
It's actually really funny. I think our teammate Gavin was here, and he was talking about card prices, and I was like, and it was actually what made me talk about this on the podcast last week. It's like, Gavin, I don't pay for Magic cards. He's like, what do you mean? And I'm like, so if I want to own Magic cards, I just buy them from Fusion for our sponsorship. And then, other than that, I can just borrow whatever I want from Oasis through that sponsorship, and it's like, I could not tell you what any Magic card costs right now. I couldn't.
I can tell you, Karn is about 2 of my cars. Sorry, continue. That was a bad joke. Sorry, continue.
Do you have no cars?
No, I have cars. It was a joke, because Karn's really high price. It's a good joke. It's good. Top 25. Continue.
Yeah, it's a top 25 joke?
Yeah.
Okay. Either way, we are in a lucky place. It's funny because, like, you might ask Spencer, how much do you pay your co-hosts and your producers? It's like, not a lot, because our sponsors pay them. I mean, you guys are making like $50 an hour doing this podcast just from sponsors alone. And I think that's good. And I hope that the way that they support us, that our listeners can support them. Also, I just looked at Karn's price, and oh my gosh.
I know, right? It's insane.
The 65 card... US is a lot for a Planeswalker.
So, like, this is the actual story. Like, it was like, I was on Fusion, the sponsor, and I was looking at the store credit, and I was like, $40 for Karn? I was like, it's probably not going to go up much more, but it's not going down for 4 months.
That's like $3 US. You should have snapped that off.
Well, I did. I took the deal. But it was like, I was like, man, this is like so much money. I'll bite the bullet, and down the road I'll regret it. And then like a week later, it's like, oh, I like doubled my money. what
happened? I mean, in Canadian, you quadrupled it. So
I'm
check out
retiring,
both of our.
So.
Yeah, I mean, he just sell those cards Canadian, and you just move to Canada. In all seriousness, we really appreciate both of our sponsors. You should definitely check them out. You can check out the rest of the network at CCMTG on the Constructive Criticism Network. That's pure. Oh my gosh, I can't even say words right now. I'm distracted. I can hear my son crying, for those wondering why I'm distracted. So don't forget to check out Limited Time Only and Common Knowledge, the 2 other podcasts on our network, as well as all the YouTube content produced by myself and Mason, whether it's Deck Techs, Wednesday Night Warrior, gameplay videos. Check it out on the YouTube channel.
Boom.
We have a special shout-out to our newest patron, Thomas Pete. Thomas is actually qualified for the next Pro Tour, and we really appreciate his contribution. He's wanted to do this for such a long time, and he's asked me about it a couple of times. Shout out to Boots Peppercorn in the chat right now. He's actually got a YouTube channel of his own playing Arena, so check him out on Twitch and on YouTube. Let's go on to our Patreon question, though, because if you're a patron of the show, you get to ask a Patreon question. And it says, hi, guys. I hope you are all well. I'm a Legacy player, but I'm considering getting back into Standard and playing some PPTQs this season. I miss having larger local events to play every weekend. My question is, how should I pick a deck going into the new format? I tend to like control slash prison deck type decks and generally see myself as a UBX shell in standard. So, Mason, you might have a different opinion of this than me.
Mm-hmm.
My opinion is, like, have a friend to play against, like, 10 games on Cockatrice with all the decks you're considering, and then buy the one you like the most. Not even the one that you win the most with. But, like, if you're going to play PPTQs in, like, local events, I would just buy the deck you like. You know, win some store credit with it to build into, to go into other decks and stuff like that. But I don't find PPTQs hard enough, and maybe I'm biased here, but I don't find PPTQs hard enough to, like, sway my decision as to, like, what deck I want to buy. Right now I own, like, green, red, black, green, and mono red. And it's like, these are just decks that I can see myself playing a PPTQ with or playing a local FNM with. For me, it's Wednesdays. I play Wednesdays cause they're higher EV than FNMs out here. And it's like, these are just the decks that I can see myself playing. And it's not even a matter of like, what's the best deck for me at that level. It's like, what can I see myself playing and winning with? And if you just, like, jam 10 games with any deck, you're probably going to see how much you like the deck and what you can see yourself doing with it.
Yeah, I like that. I also like to say that, like, after this episode, it's going to be so easy for them to win because we teach them all the
tricks. Oh, man. Oh, man.
There you go. But, no, I agree. So it kind of depends on what your goal is, right? So if your goal is just to, like, play some local PPDQs, play, like, a Wednesday tournament, a couple FNMs, you know, whatever. I love Spencer's idea. I think if you're trying to play more competitively, it's hard, like, to only have one deck or have access to that. So I kind of like Spencer's idea where you just kind of stick with the deck for a standard season, grind with it, and then you can, like, build out your collection for other future standard seasons. And it's good to enjoy something.
Yeah, with that being said, I did want to read the rest of their question because I wanted to kind of separate it. They said, I played a few leagues with this deck list. Mason will put that on the screen. I replaced Commit Memory with Nicol Bolas. I enjoyed almost all the games but did not have a winning record. Is this a deck that's worth spending time on and learning? I think that I have a shot winning most games I played, except for the games against Dante Vanguard and Black White Vehicles. I'm not sure that this is the best as a question of the week or a deck doctor. If you like the question, feel free to answer in the segment. Otherwise, thank you so much for what you're doing. So I do have a thought on this. I don't hate this deck list. I don't hate this style of deck. The thing is that at the PPTQ level and at the FNM level, I do think that the thing that you're rewarded for is, like, having fun and enjoying yourself and, like, playing your best Magic. So while I probably wouldn't start myself in a blue X control starting point, that doesn't mean that it's wrong. I think Surtrash Conta is an extremely powerful Magic card, but I might consider trying out some of those blue-white decks before I bought into something. Just see, like, what is all this Teferi nonsense about and see if that's something that you might enjoy more.
Yeah, I forgot what their name is on the Patreon question, so I'm sorry if you said that and I forgot, but...
Oh, I can't pronounce... it's Kyo, or Xiao. I've only talked to him, like, 17 times in person.
Okay, so it's not like you should know their name. That's reasonable.
I definitely shouldn't know how to pronounce Kyo's name, but I'm pretty sure it's Kyo.
All right, Kyo, I'm doubling down on Kyo. You said you like control decks and prison decks. That's literally what the blue-white Pull from Tomorrow deck that Brian Gottlieb has talked a lot about on Game Podcast and just got second at the GP. And I'm sure we're going to talk about that a little bit later. We'll touch on it. I would look at that deck. I would pull that up on Cockatrice and play that because that's, like, a very pure control deck. And then when you ultimate Teferi, you kind of become like, all right, well, how do I kill your resources with a draw every turn? And it's so much fun.
Ultimate Teferi, that's not how you win with that deck. You Teferi minus targeting itself to make it the only card left in your deck multiple times to win the game through that.
Well, you can do that, but you try and ultimate it, and then then you have Commit to Memory, and you ultimate, and you're like, Memory, we both draw seven, but you have seven less lands. All right, go. And then you start minusing the Teferi on itself.
You're trying way too hard, man. Like, you just mill them out by targeting itself. It's, like, the best.
That's the most efficient way to use Teferi, is every turn you play it, and then you're like, minus, and they're like,
target. I mean, clearly this is your fourth Teferi that you've played, or, you know, your 32nd Teferi that you've played, right?
Yeah, I know, I agree. I'm just saying we've ultimated, like, the second one. The first one died, and the second one ultimated, and now we're just minusing until they concede, because we can never deck.
Is it draw cards? I thought it was cast triggers.
No. It's whenever you draw a card. That's why they play pull from Namara. So you ultimate, and then your plan is to pull or commit to memory.
So if you, like, pull for five, they lose the game?
Basically, yeah. That's the idea. And then you pull with all the card advantage. And then once you have the ultimate, you just minus on your Teferi because they can never kill you.
Yeah. So it's just hashtag always improving is the next segment of this podcast. We believe if you're not getting better, you're getting worse. We want to be doing what we can all the time to be getting better ourselves. And this week I learned that Teferi's ultimate is on draws and not
I knew casts. It. I knew you were going to say that. Yeah. It's so funny.
No, here's the thing, is I had a rough week. You might know that we're recording this on Tuesday. And maybe this is the right time of the show to say this. So first of all, I'm a human being, and because we are family appropriate, I can't say the things that I want to say, but to all the haters out there that are messaging me bad words and emailing me, I can say, forget you. Like, my son was in the hospital this week, and it was probably, like, one of the bigger weeks of hate for me as far as podcasting, and whatever, guys. Like, if you don't like the show, don't listen. Like,
yeah, stop giving us views. If you don't like it, don't download. Like, your plan is to, like, send Spencer mean words. It's like, my plan is to give you views so you can get more sponsors. Ha ha ha.
It's just insane. It's like, here's the thing, is I'm sure that not everybody's going to like the show, and there's multiple reasons. We're a little self-righteous. Like, we believe if you're not getting better, you're getting worse. Catchphrase is like, we believe it. That's why we say it. But also, it's a little self-righteous. Like, the idea of hashtag always improving, the idea of hashtag would that be good, like, the idea of the training runs, like, we 100% are a show that is saying that, like, you're not as good as you think you are. But I think that what's lost in a lot of that is that that includes ourselves. Like, we also don't believe that we are as good as we think we are. And I think that the better you get at Magic, the more you realize, like, you're actually effectively terrible at this game. And you should get over yourself and realize that you have a lot to improve on. And
agreed. If you think, like, not an initial with a V, you're probably not as good as you think you are.
I mean, at least one V, maybe a couple P's.
PV, LSV.
John Finkel mother effing V. Like, you know. But here's the honest truth, is that Owen Turtenwald listens to the game podcast. There's not a world in which Owen Turtenwald is not better at Magic than Jerry Thompson. Huey Jensen told me that he's listened to this podcast. And let me tell you something. It's not a world in which Huey Jensen is not a better Magic player than me or Michael Hinderaker. But the truth is those guys are always trying to improve. And if there's anything I can learn from this week, it's that I need to just say, screw the haters, and let them be fuel to my fire for trying to improve and get back to the Pro Tour. One of the awesome things that happened this week is my wife and I looked over the GP schedule, and outside of GP Portland on my son's birthday, I'm going to every GP within 12-hour drive of me the next 6 or 7 months. And, you know, I'm going to try and get bronze. I'm going to try and do the things that I can do as an MTG dad. But with that being said, I'm human. And I really don't appreciate the hate. Like, I'm so glad that you took time out of your day. You literally messaged me on my personal device. I'm just going to read the name. Whatever. Screw it.
No, I think that's giving them too much attention.
No, it's fine.
Okay.
Karin.hannah.g@icloud.com messaged me to call me a bitch. I just want to say, okay. Whatever. I give out my personal cell phone number to people to be kind. To say, if you're going through some stuff, let me help you out. I'm happy to talk to you. And I've had multiple listeners contact me via Facebook, via my cell phone, via email. And the way you decided to contact me was to call me a bitch. cool. I hope you feel good. But I'm going to go get bronze next year. And I'll see you guys all at the Pro Tour. Mason, how did you improve this week?
Well, mine's a lot less heavy. I picked up humans as a deck. It's pretty great. Why didn't no one tell me humans was great? No, joking aside, I was trying to figure out what I'm going to do for Vegas, and I was like, well, I should probably start with playtesting humans since I haven't really played it since it first came out, like, as a deck, and obviously it's improved drastically since then, even if the sideboard hasn't. And I decided to stream in and play some leagues and, like, pretty easy 5-0, had a 14-card sideboard, and so now I'm like, all right, well, I'm going to keep looking at this human deck for the next couple weeks. So just been playing a lot of humans, absorbing a lot of content about humans and reading articles and trying to figure out sideboard stuff. I got to talk to, I forgot their name, but Zach something was a friend of Caroline who played like the last PT and played humans there, and I got to talk to him for a little bit about humans. So just getting to get all the different ideas about humans was really awesome. So that was my always improving moment for the week.
Cool.
Yep. All Restoration right. Angels main, baby. Let's go.
I played a lot of humans going into the last Modern Grand Prix that I went to, and then Oasis didn't have the cards for all of us to play humans, so I played Jund.
Yep. That's because we promoted the sick deals too much.
Those sick deals, man. Those sick deals.
Insane.
All right, so the next segment would be Deck Doctor. We don't have one this week, but if you're a patron of $5 or more, don't forget that you can go to patreon.com, go to the Deck Doctor thread, and submit a Deck Doctor for us to talk about on the show. We are not doing power rankings this week, and the reason is because the number one deck would have been so far ahead of the rest of the decks.
Mm-hmm.
We just want to talk about this. So, we're going to talk about Black Red Aggro in Standard. This deck had 6 of the top 8, as well as tons of copies in the top 32. So, let's look at Simon Nelson's list in the top 8. We have 2 Walking Ballista, 3 Soul Scar Mage, 4 Scrap Heap Scrancher, 4 Goblin Chainwheeler, 2 Pianillar. Her husband's apparently dead. I'm really sorry about that.
My father.
Shout out to Chantel.
Alright, continue.
I mean, I was going to make a joke about that later in the podcast, but
can still make the joke later in the podcast. Don't worry.
Alright. I mean, apparently you just told me I'm dead. 2 Rekindling Phoenix, 2 Glorybringer, 2 Chandra, 2 Karn, 2 Magma Spray, 4 Braid, 3 Unlicensed Disintegration, 3 Heart of Kirin, and 25 lands, including an Aether Hub and 1 Swamp. So kind of doubling down on those sources, but only playing 2 Spire of Industry. Okay.
A lot to go over.
There's so much to go over.
So I guess I'll start with one of the things I really like about this deck is...
This list or the deck?
This list is they prepared for Red-Black to be a good deck, and they made their deck kind of bigger main deck and have less one-toughness creatures, because Chainwhirler is a way to like really get ahead in the Red-Black matchup. Because if you're playing Bowmat Couriers and stuff like that, and they play a Chainwhirler, you just get X for 1 immediately. So I like that kind of stuff that's going on, and I like how the bigger diverse threats they have in the sideboard, but that's getting a little bit ahead of us. Do you like that change, Spencer? Do you like the Bowmat Courier builds, or do you like these more mid-range-ish builds?
So, my Wednesday Warrior video this week was literally me going over every single red-black deck in the top 8.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a few things that I really, really, really like that I think you should be doing. The first thing is some inclusion of Magma Spray in the main deck. The second thing is some inclusion of Soul Scar Mage in the main deck. And then I do like Glorybringer in the main in some number. I don't know if it's 1 or 2. But one thing that I really hate is the Swamp. So if I was going to change Simon's deck list, that Swamp would become a Spire of Industry so fast that, you know, my head would spin. But outside of that, I really like his land package. I think 2 Chandra, 2 Karn is 100% correct. And then once we get into the sideboard, you know, his sideboard is very diverse, right? It's 1 cut, 1... Glory, 1 Aggrath, 1 Contempt, 1 Chandra, 1 Karn, 1 Heartless Pillage, we'll get into that later, 1 Fiery Cannonade, that seems interesting, a Doomfall, a Release, 3 Duress, and 2 Chandra's Defeat. So, his sideboard is super diverse, right? Like, it's a ton of one-ofs. I mean, literally 10 one-ofs. But one thing that we see that's very clear is he wants to be able to go Heart, crit with Pia, crit with Goblin Chain Whirler, crit with Scrap Heap, you know, so play Chandra and Karn, get to, you know, uptick plus cruit or downtick plus cruit. Both of them, actually Chandra can do that, right? Because she's a minus three.
Yeah, you can't minus Chandra and crew with Heart profitably.
But wait, you can play Chandra plus play Heart, which is pretty powerful too.
Yeah.
So the deck is a Heart of Kieran deck. And I think that the inclusion of Magma Spray and Soulscar Mage is really great. I think that this deck is short as a Soulscar Mage in the main deck.
It's playing three, right?
Yeah. And other than that, I think the main deck is great. I don't know what the correct sideboard for this deck is, and I don't think that we would know that for quite a while. But the thing that I want to talk about really quick is like a simple summary of the deck. And I think the easiest thing that we can say is it is the better and probably the best Heart of Kieran Planeswalker deck in the format right now.
Yeah, I think with the way the format's lined up right now, if I'm trying to play a Heart of Kieran Karn deck, I like this one. I think it does a good job of being aggressive in the game one without having some cards that are like suspicious, like Toolcraft Exemplar times. And then it transitions into a bigger mid-range deck that maybe can't outpower the decks like Snake as easily with their big board clears, but it can still have game against them.
I actually think that like the reason that I like Simon's version of the deck is that it plays Glorybringer in the main, really increasing your matchup against things like Black Green. Because, you know, if you're in our testing team and paying attention to our Google Docs, you know that I lost to Black-Green or Black-Red multiple times with the Llanowar Elves version of this deck and couldn't beat it until I actually completely cut Llanowar Elves from my deck. But if other people get on the plan of, like, cutting Llanowar Elves and just playing a very value-based green-black deck, which is, I believe, the correct way to do this, then two Rekindling Phoenix, two Glorybringer, a couple of Chandra, a couple of Karn is, like, a great way to actually beat that deck. Like, that's actually a problem for the black-green deck.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that cutting down on the number of total Walking Ballistas is a good look for that, where maybe you're not playing four, and you go all the way down to two to kind of make sure that your mid-range package is perfect to try and attack those other great mid-range decks with Snake being the best.
I'm sorry, are you talking about Snake going down to two Ballista or Red-Black going down to two Ballista?
Red-Black going
down
to two.
Okay, sorry, I got confused for a second. Yeah, all right, I got really confused. I was like, whoa, Snake and Ballista, come on. Let's not get crazy land. But yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense to me. I do agree, like, I think the Elf is okay in Snake, and people are really high on it, but I do think the deck is better when it's played as a pure mid-range deck. Especially since post-board, it normally wants to do that anyways, and Elf is like a real liability with Chain Whirler, and it's like a really bad late game draw. So I really like that you've cut Elf from the Snake deck completely.
I think that also just like, if you just play like two leagues with the deck, you'll immediately see how much better Adventuring Impulse is on turn one than Elf is. And if that's true, then you just want to max out on like the number of effective two drops that you play. So that you can go Impulse or Push on their card, or on your side, go into your two-drop package, and then have the correct number of threes. And because of Impulse, you can play, like, a good number of threes, right? Like, you can play a couple of Brontodon, maybe even a main deck, what's the Exile Graveyard?
Death Gorger Scavenger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, you get a good number of threes with Rishkar in those, and that's also the reason that I think that Simon was really in the right place, because I think he leveled where I would have been. Like, if I had gone to this GP, I would have been on Snake minus Llanowar Elves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that his deck is still okay against me. And I think I talked about this a little bit on the First Strike podcast this week. If they build their red-black deck correctly in the main deck, it's probably one of your worst matchups.
I agree.
Now, that makeup has to include flyers, right? So it has to include Rekindling Phoenix and Glorybringer in some number. But I don't know how hard that is.
Yeah, that is the interesting part of this, right? Is how greedy do these black-red decks want to go when compared to, like, fighting other mid-range decks like Green Black, and then also getting that gives them the leg up in the mirror, because before this weekend, some people were playing Bowmite Couriers and stuff, like Yu-Gi-Oh! Players list, for example. And when you do that kind of stuff, you cannibalize yourself, and you make yourself better in those matchups, but then decks like Blue-White come in, and they have a better matchup, right? Because you're not getting under them as much. You're not slipping underneath the counter spells. You're playing more bigger cards, more grindier cards. And they're like, oh, you want to play a grindy game plan? Hello Teferi. So it is going to be interesting to see where these black-red decks try and position themselves and what they try and do with their sideboard as well to fight this. Because I think they have a lot of the tools they need to fight these decks. It's just figuring out on the weekend which version of the deck to play.
And you know, one of the things that we'll see is if you look at like the green-black constructor that top 8 did, they had 4 Land of Werewolves and only 1 Fatal Push. Well, like, how do you lose to a Heart of Kirin deck? Specifically a Heart of Kirin Chain Whirler deck, and it's probably just playing a Land of Werewolves over Fatal Push just puts you at a huge dog in that matchup. So I think that one of the innovations that we'll see in the coming weeks is, like, probably no Land of Werewolves, more Fatal Push, and then kind of deciding, is Blossoming Defense even worth it at this point? Do you actually want to spend a mana to save any of your creatures? Because it is basically green dispel at this point in the format. And it's like, what is that good against? If the entire format is like a Walking Ballista format, I don't know that I like Blossoming Defense that much.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's its key matchup against green black. And then if we look at the other non black red deck that top 8ed, you know, This Leo deck is 4 Teferi.
I think it's like 3 Pull from Tomorrow and a commit.
It's 2 Pull from Tomorrow, 1 commit, 2 Fumigate, 3 Settle, 4 Disallow, 3 Essence Scatter, 3 Blink of an Eye, 2 Syncopate, 3 Seal Away, 2 Search, 3 Cast Out. Like, this is blue-white control, guys. Like, this is not even blue-white control. This is Spencer Quentin blue-white control. If you've been a fan of the podcast for a long time, you know, this is a Spencer Quentin deck. We're talking about team decks for the team RPTQ. And Teferi, it's so funny because, like, one of the first decks that Mason and I worked on was Bant.
Bant's son, Bant, baby.
Bant approach because of how good Teferi was in the deck.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't know if this deck is better than Bant. I think that it's not favored against Bant, but it might be favored against the field. I really like this deck. The only... I actually, looking at this deck list, I can actually understand the reasons for every number in this deck. Like, typically when I look at a control deck, I'm like, oh man, if I could just cut this for something else. But when I look at this deck, I'm like, okay. Okay. I get it.
Mm-hmm.
The 3 Meandering Rivers is a lot of tap lands when you already include Irrigated Farmland.
Yeah, it feels like they had no Ipnu Riverlands, right? Like, you could play some of those. I don't know. They're pretty good at Teferi.
Yeah, I mean, especially in the mirror, right? Like, you definitely want to have Ipnu Rivulet against Teferi. So, other than that, though, but I want to specifically talk about this in the context of Black-Red.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that this deck does really, really well is it says, forget you and License Disintegration. You don't matter.
Oh, you're talking about the blue-white. Yeah. Yeah, that's the biggest draw to the blue-white deck, right? Is that you blank all their removal. Like, it's not like some of the decks where you had Lyra or Gearhulk, and they're sitting on 2 cards in here, like, I wonder what it could be, you know, and then you get bolted. But that deck literally blanks those cards the entire match. In fact, it makes you have to use them in smart ways, where you're like, seal away your scrounger, and like, abrade my scrounger, so that I can buy it back.
Yeah, one of the things that I think is really important here, you know, even if we look at the sideboard of some of this blue-white deck, is that the History of Benalias are not in the main. They're in the side, and they're saying, like, I will blank your removal to the point where you have no choice but to bring it out, and when you do that, I'll bring in History, and my History will be great against you. And
it's actually genius, too, right? Because the blue deck takes forever to win, so you know they don't have creatures. Sorry, continue.
Yeah, no, it's fine. But that being said, the black red deck did beat this.
Yes. So, did you get to see any of the GP top 8?
I got to see a little bit of it. But why don't you talk about what your thoughts are?
Sure. So I watched 99% of the top eight. And then I started my stream because I thought Blue White was going to win, and then somehow Black Red overcame and then won game three. But he, the person who was playing Blue White, played Black Red in the quarters, the semis, and the finals.
Yes.
Yeah. And so they did really well. Now, ironically, it's like each time they played, their person's deck got like bigger, or sorry, like kind of smaller. It was like mid-rangey, and this one's a little bit faster than the other one he played. But regardless, the games were always close, and they would just pull ahead slightly, and then he would win. So I think the matchup is pretty close, but I think the problem for Red-Black is that you're down game one. Like, they all lost game one against him in, like, pretty impressive fashion. So I think they really have to lean on their sideboard games to win. So, okay. Yeah, that's what I was going to say, is that game one, I think you're heavily favored, though.
Are we kind of in agreement that the top three decks right now are Black, Red, Green, Black, and Blue, White, though?
Black, Red, Green, Right.
Green, Black, and Blue, White. I think they're clear so. Top three decks. And it's so funny, because, like, did Adventurous Impulse do that much for Green, Black? And did Teferi do that much for Blue, White? I guess it's Seal Away, too, but it's so much. And then when you look at Black, Red, you know, early on in the format, we were like, oh, it's mono red because then you can play Chain Whirler. And the people were like, no. I'm going to play Scrappy Scrounger. And I'm going to do it for free while still playing Chain Whirler.
Yeah, and get all of the great sideboard cards.
Yeah. So it really made this, like, really aggressive mid-range deck with a great sideboard plan. And classically, if you look at things like Bloodbraid Elf Jund, you know, other style of black-red. Mardu Vehicles. Green-white tokens. These aggressive mid-range decks have done a really good job of being, like, the decks to beat. And so it is not surprising to me. Going into this weekend, the deck I lost to the most on MTGO was Black-Red Vehicles. It wasn't even close. It might have actually been my only losses on MTGO with Green-Black Snake.
Yeah, it was really interesting, too, because, like, going into the GP, I kind of expected Snake to do so well because it's so good against Black-White, and Black-White had such a dominating performance.
It's good against Black-White, it's good against Control, because, like, your top decks are insane with Adventurous Impulse.
Mm-hmm.
And then Vraska, like, being really insane against Cast Out and Seal Away, right? Like, it kind of just did everything that I wanted to be doing, but when I was playing on MTGO, it was like, I don't know if I did I message to the team when I was, like, getting crushed by this deck?
I might have been busy or asleep or something. I'm not sure.
I was literally, like, I had to literally cut Lenoworlds because I was like, I cannot beat this deck with Lenoworlds in my deck. Mm-hmm. And I played against it three times. And so I immediately cut Lenoworlds and my win percentage shot up. And the thing is that I don't think that that's uncommon. I think that, like, if we look at the Dominaria set, whether it's green-white, black-green, mono-green, like, there are all these decks that are like, yeah, we're just going to jam one on a War Elves and get the mana advantage, but it's like, the thing is they didn't give us the cards that make it so that Lana War Elves gives you enough advantage before Chain Wheeler comes down on the draw.
Yeah. You don't get that far ahead.
Yeah. And the thing is that, like, the amount that Glintsleeve Siphoner is better than any other card that you can be playing in black-green means that you're already susceptible to this card. And I think that the thing that the black-red deck does so much better than the black-white deck is Chain Whirler turns the decks that, like, you care about into reasonable matchups while getting to continue to play the Karn game. Like, mm-hmm. Black-white is already good at playing Karn, but this deck gets to play Karn and Heart while also just being a good Karn and Heart deck.
Yeah, it has the mana sinks you need and it has the artifacts you need for your Karns to be really well. By the way, one thing we haven't quite mentioned yet, which maybe I'm just unlucky and this came up every time I played against this green-black snake, but Soulscar Mage plus Chain Whirler, if you have a snake out, it's just like, oh, I don't have a board anymore. You just lose your board. Like, every time. Because it quits the cat. I don't know. It's really good. You have a lot of...
No, it's so funny, because if you look at... I think it was Matt Folks that posted this deck. Mm-hmm. And he had Inventor's Apprentice over Soulscar Mage. A bunch of the decks in the top 8 did the same thing. And it's like, the amount that Soulscar Mage is better in this deck than Inventor's Apprentice is so much. Like, you gain this huge advantage from getting to, say, like, shrink your board, or even, like, even the amount that, like, Magma Spray on something with Soulscar Mage in play is a big deal. And that's the other thing, like, we've talked so much about, like, Chain Whirler, but the fact that Simon included Magma Spray for both the Mirror Match and, like, kind of the other aggro decks, including Black White and Mono White and Mono Red, is, like, pretty big game, right? Like, you're saying a pretty big commitment here by saying, I'm going to make sure your Scrap Heap Scroungers don't matter. And also just saying, whatever, I'm playing Soulscar Mage anyway, like, let's include some one-man removal spells.
Yeah. Yeah, it just makes sense, right? Like, you make that kind of change, it works so well with the deck. It's insane. It works well with your Chandra's too. We can, like, double spell after taking it up and take down your heart. There's a lot of really awesome things in this deck. I really like it. By the way, we haven't even mentioned that Simon slept through his round 9 and still won the GP. That's how insane this deck is.
I actually don't think that's Simon's biggest accomplishment. I think the biggest accomplishment is probably his hair and facial hair change. Like, the amount that he looks better during this GP than all of his other GPs is pretty significant. Like, the dude was looking good. Like, the facial hair change and the long hair man bun change. Like, I really appreciated his, like, aesthetic look as well.
Maybe that's the secret, is he was actually preparing because he knew he was going to top 8 back at his hotel room, and he's just like, oh, yeah, I slept through it. That way people didn't think he was vain.
Ooh,
maybe,
yeah.
That was the trick.
Because I mean, he was looking good, so shout out to Simon. Tips and trick for this deck, I would say that, like, your Planeswalkers matter a lot because of your Heart of Kirin's. And then outside of that, I think that the way that Simon built his deck is really good in the main deck, and you just need to adjust your sideboard.
Yeah, I think making sure that your sideboarding plan makes sense, and I think it's one of those decks where you're almost always sideboarding. A lot like Black-White, where you sideboard a whole lot when you play that deck. I've only played one league with it. It was last week, so like the meta games changed a lot in that time, but I was sideboarding every single game. So I think you just have to like learn what you're sideboarding, have a plan for the decks, and this deck will succeed. It's so good.
Yeah. Yep. Let's move on to our turning around. So this week on the podcast, we want to go to How to Win a PPTQ Part 2. And I think this will be our last part. You know, I thought we would split this into 3 or 4 episodes, but I think that this part really covers what the truth is behind winning a PPTQ.
Mythic rares. I'm just joking. Sorry.
You know, when we were messaging about this, I said, I think that playing the entire event should be part 2 of this. You know, we talked about preparation before and things you might need to do to prepare for a PPTQ, but I think that this part of the show and this part of this topic is just understanding that the +3 is a real part of any tournament, that the only prize you care about is first.
Yeah, I cannot undersell that. Like, one of the things I think about and I notice in myself when I'm playing, and while watching others too, like once I'm qualified, since I like to actually go to the PPTQs that my friends are playing once I'm already qualified and watch, is the mentality that they have, and myself as well, where it's like the only thing that really matters is winning. And it's like, oh, I'll just be happy to top 8. It's like, well, would you really just be happy to top 8? Like, if last Thursday we were talking and I said, hey, you're going to top 8 this coming weekend, would that really make you happy? Is that why you go to the tournament to top 8? So I really like that point. I think it's very important to, like, remember, your goal is trying to get to the RPTQ to get to the Pro Tour, right? Now, maybe that's not your goal at the event, but it probably is. And to do that, you have to focus on winning and, you know, playing tight and all that kind of stuff. And we're getting into more things along that line, but you can't veer away and just be like, oh, I'm just happy I got to top 8.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things, if you're a member of the Constructor Criticism family, you saw some of our updates this week as far as the podcast goes. And we'll mention some of those next week as we move towards the future of CCMTG. But one of the things we talked about is, like, we're going to start over. You know, we're almost on 5 years of podcasting. So many of the players listening to the show are new players. They haven't been listening for 5 years. And I'm going to tell a story that I've told in the show probably pretty early on. And that was, so during early episodes of the show, there was a tournament called the Utah Invitational Series, which is a creation of mine. And eventually, Game Grid and Oasis Games left the series. And they turned themselves into the Utah MTG Open, which only lasted for one event. But I happened to take second at that event.
Scoreboard.
It was some good money. We split in the top two, so I literally got the same prize as first place. But one of the things that happened during that event was pretty pivotal in my pivotal in my Magic career. And Alex Sittner and I were talking in between rounds. I don't remember what round it was, but I said only X number of rounds left, and then Alex said, no, there's X number plus 3 rounds left. And I was like, what are you talking about? And he's like, well, my goal is not to top 8 this tournament, it's to win it. And it was a huge click in my head. It was like, I have been looking at Magic tournaments wrong this entire time. Because the thing that I've been looking at is like, what record do I need to top 8?
Mm-hmm.
And I should be good enough to just top 8.
Yeah.
The record that I need to top 8 shouldn't actually matter. And that the thing that I need to focus on is playing every game the same way to give myself the best chance to win every game I play. Because whether it is round 1 or the semifinals, my goal is to win the match of Magic. And the number of rounds left and the games that I'm in and the games that are remaining honestly don't matter.
Yeah, they're non-factors, right? Like, the fact that you have, like, you're in the semis does not mean that, you know, this game should, is going to be any different, right? It's just you're
no,
in the semis.
No, it just doesn't matter, right? Yeah. Like, and the thing that I like to think about with a lot of these is PDQs did a really good job symbolizing this in that, like, why did you go to an old school PDQ? It was probably to qualify for the Pro Tour. And if you didn't get first, why did it matter? And pretty early on in my Magic career, I cared a lot about top 8ing PDQs. I top 8ed a lot of PDQs. But I didn't ever win an old school PDQ. I didn't win one. And a huge part of that was the satisfaction that I got from that top 8.
Oh, yeah. I can't tell you how many times I've, like... So one thing I like to do, and I don't know how other people feel about this, is when we get to the finals of PBDQ, I offer a prize structure rearrange so that first place gets the invite and second place gets all the packs they would win.
Yes, I do that every time.
Yeah, because to me, and this is how I say it, and this might be something that's helpful for other people, is like, all I care about is the invite, and I didn't want to waste my day doing this and not get the invite, so at least I get 200 packs or whatever.
Right? Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah. I offer the same price split every finals that I'm in.
Do you feel like your opponents get sloppier sometimes? Because I feel that 100%.
I mean, I've gotten 2 concessions out of it.
Oh, okay. I never got a concession, but all right, continue. Sorry.
I've literally won 2 PPDQs from this prize split, and Casey won a PPDQ against me in the finals because I was having a baby and said, second place gets everything, and he's like, deal, and I said, okay, I concede.
Yeah.
Like, I myself have gotten the other side of that twice, where it was like, second place gets all the prizes, first place gets the invite, and they said, okay, and then while we were shuffling up, they conceded to me. And mm-hmm. The thing is that, like, this emphasizes how much to me first place matters. Like, I could... It's funny, because it's like, Spencer, what are you doing? You just gave $80 away. Your entry was, what, $20? And it's like, I only showed up for one reason.
Yeah, exactly. I've had people tell me that before, and I'm like, well, think of it this way, right? So I get all my weekends off. I don't have to pay for any tournaments. And above all that, my goal was to come here to win this tournament, to then have a chance to get top 4 another tournament, to then go play the Pro Tour. So this was step 1 of my goal. And having, like, you know, these 20 packs won't matter at all.
Yeah, I don't know what those... I don't know what this half a box pays for, but it's certainly not the amount that, like, winning the PBDQ matters for me. Mm-hmm. And I think that understanding the games in that fashion is really important. Like, obviously, I've conceded in the finals because of this price split, and you offered this price split, and people have conceded me for this price split. But I think that actually says more about the people conceding than it does about, like, your overall goal. Because the only prize that matters at a PBDQ, if your goal is to win, is winning.
Yep.
Like, that's it. I don't care how many hours I've spent. I don't care I don't care about my preparation. I don't care about anything. Like, I came here to beat you, and that's my goal.
100%. I echo that statement a lot, and it's like, so I understand for some people they might not have to have time for the RPTQ. You know, for some people they just can't do with work and they just want to play a tournament. And I totally get conceding there, but a lot of people don't go there for that, and then it's just kind of like, well, you know, maybe you shouldn't have even. I don't know. I shouldn't say you shouldn't have came to the tournament, but if your goal is to win and then you're like giving up when you make top eight, we're not trying your best. You need to like reevaluate why you're thinking that way and then to that.
I think that it's not our job to define how somebody else spends their Saturday or their Sunday, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's not my position to say, but like my goal is Swiss plus three.
Yeah, definitely.
That's my goal. Like I'm going to put myself in the best position to win Swiss plus three every single time. And if it's Swiss plus two because of some weird, it's really Swiss plus three because like of the way they structure it. But like my goal is going to be to win the event. And there are a few things that go into that. And I think another thing that like gets lost a lot for a lot of people is positioning yourself for top eight. So for me, and maybe for you, Mason, It's pretty common for me to be 3-0 at an event.
Agreed.
And this event is 5 rounds plus top 8.
Sounds like an average PBDQ.
Yeah, pretty average. And so I'm 3-0, I draw. And the number of people that like to double draw is honestly surprising to me. Because the reason that you double draw is to lock yourself into the 2 or 3 spot 100% of the time. If you're not locking yourself into the 2 or 3 spot, it's pretty silly for you to double draw. Like, I'm not double drawing for the 4-5 slot. I'm just going to play the other 4-5 player. And one thing that you have to think about is, like, this is a bracket. And I want to put myself in the best position to, like, do well in this bracket. People might think this is a little scummy. I've played a lot of games once where I've lost and then offered the draw. I'll draw now. You want to draw? And if they say no and I beat them, I offer the draw again. I'm like, hey, I'm still not at 100% advantage. Let's draw. And this has done well for me. Maybe you don't think it's scummy?
I don't think that's scummy, no. I would argue, and this isn't, you know, I'm not trying to like one-up here or anything, but I think I have done scummier things than that, where I have played for seeding in the round 5 on multiple occasions and knocked people out of top 8.
Oh, I've done that too.
Yeah. I would argue.
Why is that scummy?
People seem to get that vibe. And normally when I'm doing it, it's like later in the season. I'm like really trying to make sure I'm on the play for top 8. Yeah. And then, or I'm trying to get a friend into top 8. Like a friend's close on Breakers. It's like, listen, I'm sorry, but to get my friend Trey into top 8, I have to beat you. So we have to play this round. We can't draw.
So I have opinions on this. And I've done videos on this before. But one of the things that I think is the most important thing to recognize in the PBDQ, RBDQ, and even PBDQ setting is that you have one job, and that's to win the match in front of you. If the player in front of you doesn't want to draw, doesn't want to, you know, concede to you, It's your job to beat them. Like, they are not supposed to do anything. And to think that they're supposed to do anything is a little ridiculous. And one of the things that I think that Matt Kling and I have talked about a lot is, like, so Matt Kling, to a fault, does not ask for the draw or the concession. And I think it's disadvantaged him a lot. Like, understanding where people are in the tournament and, like, what you can be doing is important. So, for example, I talked about how, like, the only reason for a double draw is if it locks into the 2 or the 3 seed. So I've double drawn when I know that's what's going to happen to me. I know one person can jump the 2 of us. And I say, okay, like, I'm fine being the 2 or the 3. I'm okay with that. You can't fault me for saying I am not okay with being the 4, the 5, and the 6, so we're going to play because even if I lose, I'm the 7. Yeah. And I'd rather risk being the 7 than be the 4 off of a draw. And I think that that's important. I think that understanding like how a top 8 works, how the points break down, how tournament math works is worth saying. This is what I want to be doing because it makes sense for me and gives me the best chance to win this tournament.
Yeah, I like that a lot. You know, there was something like this happened at a PBDQ this past weekend where someone was guaranteed to make top 8 if the other person conceded. But the other person, if they played it out and they won, and then the table above them, one of the players won, they would actually jump into 8th seed. And they were like, listen, I understand, but I have like this 0.1% chance to make top 8, and I'm going to play to that 0.1%. And then they beat them, the right person won, and they stuck on an 8th, and then they lost in top 4. So it's like, they gave themselves that best chance to win the PPTQ. And the person that they beat, who was locked, was a friend of mine, and my friend was complaining, and I was like, I don't know what you would say, because if that was me playing against you, I would have played you as well and played for that 0.1%. So, like, don't be upset because someone you don't know did that, right? Like, they're just doing their best chance to win the tournament.
And you have to expect that from everybody, right? Exactly. Like, their job is to put themselves in the best chance to win. And if, like, you... I don't know where this came from, this feeling of, like, people owing you. But the truth is like, you're in a single-player event. And your job is to put yourself in the best position to win. Obviously, this entire training grounds is about putting that chance on yourself.
And staying in that mindset.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you don't owe it to anybody. You know, Michael Hinderrock and I and other teammates and I have drawn in weird rounds of PPTQ. And people are like, what are you doing? And it's like, if I win this round, we still have to win our next round to top 8 together. So I'd rather draw with him and then just beat whoever our next opponent is so that we can both top 8 and give our team the best chance to win a PPTQ. Because even if we do that, we're still the 2 or 3 seed. And if we don't do that, we're going to miss top 8. But we're going to miss top 8 anyway because nobody can draw with us in the next round. And it is understanding tournament math and how things break out that you do those kind of things, that you make those kind of decisions. And when you look at a tournament in Swiss and then top 8, you don't see those things. You don't look at the tournament in those aspects. Mm-hmm. And people are like, how do you win PPTQs? It's like, well, I know what I have to do to win a PPTQ, and I'm going to put myself in the best position to win every one that I play in. Mm-hmm. And I'm certainly not going to draw with you when it's not advantageous to draw with you. Because if I'm gonna draw with you and be the 4th seed, there's actually not a big difference between that and the 7th seed. And
sorry, continue.
Go ahead.
I had a question for you about choosing not to draw when the matchup is bad for you in top 8 and you're most likely play against them in top 8. Have you ever?
I don't think you can know that. So here's the thing that I notice in PPTQs.
Yeah.
So the 1 seed is usually a lock. It's usually going to be a player that has to play.
Yeah, definitely.
So, and you can't know who's going to win that match.
Mm-hmm.
So I ignored that one, right? The 2 and 3 are either going to be 2 people that double drew, or they're going to be another player that had to play, and then the top seed of the draws, and then 4 is going to be the other draw, right? Mm-hmm. So those top 4 slots are locked in most PPTQs.
I agree.
The 5 is likely either another double draw or is a draw loss. The 6 is a draw loss. And then the 7 and the 8 are either a draw loss and an X2 or a draw loss and a draw loss. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't actually think that even in any PPTQ, you get a situation where you get to know the decks. Because you can't guarantee, like, because this is maybe Mason, you can disagree with me. I think you're cheating. I mean, you are cheating. If you know the 1 seed going into your draw, it means that you waited to fill out your match slip to the point where you were doing it at an advantage, and it's actually against the rules.
Yeah, no, I might have done this in the wrong sense. What I meant is,
okay,
and I've never done this. It's actually something that came up in conversation a couple weeks ago. Yeah. I don't know anyone that's done it, no. But basically the idea is like, cool. I'm playing a deck that's bad against Sun, right?
I don't believe that what you're saying is usually legal. Okay. So what happens pretty often, this is something that happened in PTQs all the time that was infuriating, is people would like just watch the game next to them.
Oh, I'm not talking about that at all. Okay.
No, hold on. But let me explain. So people used to at PTQs used to watch the game next to them and wait to see who won, decide if they wanted to draw. And to be fair, there is one PPTQ where this happened to me, where the player to my left won, and I offered the draw to my opponent. And technically, I can't offer the draw, or we can't draw because that player won, but there's nothing stopping us from drawing at this point. We were 1-1 at the time. It's mm-hmm. like, do you want to draw? It's like, cool. Okay, we're both locked for top eight. Because the player that won took ninth because we drew.
Okay.
Because of the pair up, pair down. And this was really common in PPTQs. This is actually how you could gain an advantage, but unless you do it to perfection without breaking the rules, it's likely you're breaking the rules doing it.
So, okay, I think I did a terrible job explaining this. Okay. So, forget what I said before, and I'm going to try saying it one more time.
Okay.
So, you're paired against someone, and you think you are locked for top eight, and you're not sure if they are.
Oh.
It is a bad matchup.
Oh, and you're trying to beat them out of top
eight? Exactly.
So,
like, let's say you're on blue-white
approach. I've done this.
Okay, yeah, and I'm on bad deck that's bad against it. Do I try and beat you? Have you ever done that before? I never had that happen.
Yeah. So, we're in Wyoming at Dart City or whatever. Dave's Darts in Wyoming. I am 4-0 at this old school PTQ. I get the pair down. I am 100% locked for top eight. And I know my opponent's on Green Red Tron while I am on Jund.
Oh, yeah.
I am 1,000% to play that match.
Mm-hmm.
1,000%. So I play game one. I get thoroughly crushed. I offer him the draw. He says a no. I play turn one Deathrite Shaman, turn two something else, turn three Bloodbred Elf into Liliana, and then he offers me the draw and I accept.
Yeah.
So, if I had won game one, there's a 0% chance that I take that draw. I just roll the dice.
Oh, definitely.
And
yeah,
it was 100% to try and knock this guy out of top 8, because if I knock him out of top 8, first of all, I'm the one seed. Like, that's happening.
Mm.
And second of all, one less drawn deck is in the top 8. So, yeah. Those things come into consideration when you're saying the only prize that matters is first. But you have to have knowledge as to, like, what your opponent is playing going into those, right? And I think that it's reasonable to be like, hey, like, we're both playing for top 8. Like, just tell me what you're playing, so we can make an educated decision as to what we want to do.
Oh,
that's not an unreasonable question.
I feel like I know what all the top players and top people at the table are at a PBTQ.
So usually that's true for me, but I have it never happens in limited where I know that, and most of my PBTQs these days are limited.
Okay.
So a lot of the times I do find myself saying, like, hey, you know my deck, because I'm really open with players. People tend to come up to me and ask me about my decks in limited PBTQs.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really honest. I'm like, hey, like, this is my main deck configuration. Here's my two sideboard plans. And I find that most local players for me are pretty open with me when I say, like, I've been really open with you. Will you be open with me? Like, let's figure out what's best for the two of us to get into top eight. But as far as Constructed is concerned, I don't think it's that different, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
Like, if I'm sitting there saying, hey, I'm on Green Black Snake, you know I'm on Green Black Snake, I know you, and you're either on Blue White Control or Blue Black Control, like, let's talk about it, and then let's decide what we want to do. I find most players are amicable to that. Like, it's not hard. Like, they want what's best for them. And so, in those situations, I think you can just shuffle up and talk. It's not illegal for you to tell each other what decks you're on. Just talk. And then figure out what's best for you. And then make the decision accordingly.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I feel like we're getting near the end of the training ground, so I just want to go over one thing before we get close to that. And
sure.
That is, before, like, I started, like, really trying at Magic, and I was doing other things with my time, and I was just playing Magic, I would consistently top 8 PBTQs, but I never won one, right? And then I started doing these things that we talked about in the past, and I had heard you guys talk about when I was listening to the podcast before I became, you know, part of it, and not practicing as much, and playing way more Magic, and playing Magic with a purpose, and playing my games with a purpose. And since then, and since I've, like, I like to say, like, I played Magic for, like, 5 years, and I've been playing Magic for a year, right? And during that year, I haven't missed an RPTQ, and I'm not going to miss the next two. I'm already qualified for those. So it's like, I think these things really do work. And I was in a position before where I wasn't doing that. And then you do it. And I think it's you or Hinderacher said it, where it's like, once you do it once, you flip a switch. And then you kind of just know what to do. And it's so much easier.
Yeah. So let me just talk about this before we wrap up, like, how to win an RPGQ. So for me, there was a pretty big problem in my first season. And it was the first season of RPDQ, the first season of PBDQs. I actually didn't win the PBDQ until the very last PBDQ of the season. And then since then, the only RPDQ I missed, I lost to Michael Hinderacher in the finals of that PBDQ. And it was the one after my Pro Tour. And I had only played in that PBDQ. So, and then obviously I conceded to Casey in the finals of another one.
Yeah, well, we get a kid, so that doesn't count.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is that I think that what we're saying is true. I think that, like, the problem that so many people run into, and I think that you can, like, apply this way, way past PBDQs. Like, tomorrow if I told you, what is your goal when you go to a GP, Mason? Is it to cash the GP?
Well, it's always a top 8 the GP because I want to get to the Pro Tour. So that's my overarching mega goal. But my current goal is I want to at least X3 GP Vegas. So Yeah.
So I think X3 and GP is like a pretty reasonable goal. It's like it gives me a chance for a top 8. It probably locks me into cash. It puts me in a really good position to like play in my next GP for free.
Bronze
and
as well.
I think, yeah, it locks you into bronze pretty consistently, right? It's 3 pro points. If you do that a bunch of times, you're just going to lock in bronze pretty easily. And I think that the thing that happens here is, going into day 2, do you want to be X1 or X2?
Oh, I want to be XO, baby.
Yeah.
Easy.
You want to be XO.
Yeah.
And so often, people's goal, including me, this is actually a weakness of mine in GPs, it's just a day 2 the GP. And I think that the truth is that if we apply the same logic for our goals that for PBDQs that we do to GPs, we would find that the goal that we actually want to set for ourselves is X1 or better at GPs day 1.
Oh, yeah.
Because it puts you in the best position to achieve your goal. Your goal is to win the PBDQ, your goal is to cash the GP, and X1 and, you know, high seed and top 8 are the two things that equate to that when we go into the next phase of the tournament. And you have to think about every tournament as the tournament as a whole. Because if you don't, you're going to fall short of your goal. Because you decided that some arbitrary goal was more important or better than what you were doing.
It's really cliche, but you have to want it, right? You have to have the fire. Like, this past PBDQ, so this PBDQ season, I am so busy. I was only going to get to play 3 of them. And so the first PBDQ of the season was at my local store. And I was like, all right, I really need to do well at this one. I need to win this one because I will not have time to play another standard one until the standard format's way different. So all the time I've spent would be useless. And I went in there and I wanted to win, and I didn't lose a round. I lost 2 games of Magic that day. And it is true what they say, the fire. And I can see it in myself and how I play when I really want something. Because I think it is true what Spencer said last week in the PBDQ, like talking about PBDQs, where I feel like I can win one anytime in the season. So the season before, especially with teams, I was really bad at it, where it's like, well, at first, where it's like, all right, well, I have me and my 2 teammates who are really good. So it's like, one of us is going to get it eventually. You know what I mean?
So I love you, but I definitely wasn't on the PBDQ, how to win a PBDQ part 1.
No, not that part. I'm talking about last week on the podcast during hashtag would that be good.
Oh!
You talked about how you feel like you can just win one. Or no, I'm sorry, it was during the mailbag question.
Yeah. I know what you're talking about now. Okay.
So I think the fire is real, where it's like, I definitely want to get to the Pro Tour, but sometimes you're just kind of like, I had a long week at work. I only got to play like a league or 2 with my deck this week. Like, you know, these things, it's like, I'm going to play this week, I'm going to do my best, but, like, you know, I'm going to get there eventually. And you can make excuses for yourself very easily.
I think that it's so funny because my hashtag I was improving could have easily been about how unlucky I got in the PBDQ that I played in the last 2 weeks. Like, an unreasonable button. Like, it was probably the best seal pool I've ever opened.
Is this the Helm Lyra one?
Yeah, it was Helm, God. Lyra, Sarah Angel. It was the best sealed pool I've ever opened by a significant margin.
I'm so upset that you opened that sealed pool instead of me.
Dude.
Why'd you go? You could have tummy did it. So good.
I don't even have words for how it, like, every single game I lost was to Mana Flood. Every single game. And I could be upset about that, but also I just have to accept that that's part of Magic.
Yeah.
And also, like, I have to accept the number of misplays that I made throughout the match. Throughout the matches, throughout the day. The number of times that I didn't know how a card worked, how an interaction worked. You know, I had played one draft league before that tournament and went into a sealed PPTQ with basically zero experience in the format. And I think that you have to be honest with yourself as, like, why are you losing these matches at any given PPTQ? Because for me, my last PPTQ wins are unlimited. Like, let's be honest. I, at this point, because of being an MTG dad, am I better limited player than I am a constructed player. That's just true about me. Mm-hmm. That's okay. I also, my last GP cash was in constructed. So it's not like I'm not well-rounded. It's just that, if you be honest, like, what are you doing? How are you? And I've played zero Magic comparatively over the last couple months. And I think that we have to be honest with ourselves about that. Like, I think it was last week that I said, I actually listened to last week's podcast because I thought it was pretty good, with me and Michael. And I think you have to be honest, like, the person you're playing against at a GP, if they are a silver pro or better, they probably played 20 hours of Magic this week. And if you've played 5, you're at a disadvantage. And the same thing is true at a PPTQ to a lesser extent. If you played 0 hour of Magic going into this PPTQ and they played 5, you're at a little bit of a disadvantage.
Oh my gosh, yeah. It's insane. You can, I don't know about you, but I can tell the people who have played Modo and stayed on top of things and those who haven't. From, like, just the way they talk and the way they play and the way they sideboard, you just know.
If you give people one tip, say, this will be the thing that helps you win your next PPTQ, what would it be, Mason?
Oh, man. All right, you say yours. Well, I think about how I want to say this.
No, that's not fair. I pitched it to you
did
first.
Did you just do that so you could do what I did just did and we're vamping for time right now while I think about it? Oh, that's so powerful. Yeah. Jeez. Hashtag, would that be good? Mean,
hashtag, I'm the host. You go first. But no, I think if I could give one piece of advice, it would really be to, like, we say this all the time, but understanding how your decks work and what your deck's plan is so much more important than understanding, like, if your deck's plan is correct. So a really good example of this comes from the season that I won with Jeskai Control in PPTQs. I am probably 1,000% incorrect for playing Jeskai Control at so many PPTQs that season.
During Marvel.
So I don't know that people. I think it was the copycat season.
Oh, well, I thought it was Marvel because Andrew was playing the deck, but maybe it was both.
So I think that copycat was, like, the best deck, specifically 4-color copycat, because I beat it in the finals of that PPTQ. So I don't actually think Marvel was correct yet.
Okay.
But anyway, but that deck was so good against 4-color cat that the PPTQ I won, I played 4-color cat 5 times. And it was like a bye. It was like, I can't actually lose to this deck. They have 0 outs to beat me. And the thing is I knew it was good against that deck, which was the best deck, and then I knew my game plan against other decks. And even if my game plan was wrong, I knew my game plan against those decks. And I would say that, like, whether it's a sealed PPTQ or whether it's a standard PPTQ, understanding what your deck is trying to do and how it's trying to do it is more important than what your matchup looks like at the end of the day.
I agree. So my tip is going to, like, steal that, kind of, but it's
no,
like,
no, 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 that was no, no. My tip.
All right, well, here, we're gonna see how you think about it.
Okay.
So you, You want to go into it. If I had to give you one tip to win your next one, you have to go into it and want to win it. And what it means to want to win it is know your deck. Know how your deck sideboards. Know where your deck stands in the metagame. Play as much Magic as you can. I don't care if it's one league of Modo or it's 15 leagues of Modo. Like, just want it. And some people will make fun of you for practicing for a PBDQ and going that hard, but I promise if you put in the time and effort and the work, it will pay off. So you just have to really want it and dedicate yourself and acknowledge this is something that you really want and you want to work towards, and it's okay to be really passionate about that thing and really want it. And, you know, like, people are going to, like, some people will make fun of you for trying so hard for, like, a PBDQ, but if that's where you're at, that's where you're at, and you need to put that work in. And just doing that work will pay off.
You make me feel bad, man.
Why?
I don't know. I've talked about this on the podcast before. My friend group is, like, kind of elitist, where people have come up to me asking for signatures, and as they're walking away, my friends make fun of them. And I can tell that they can hear my friends making fun of them. And I feel super bad. And I, like, go up to the players. I'm like, hey, my friends are jerks. I'm really sorry. But I think that PBDQs are the same way where, like... So, like, let's just look at my friend group, right? So it's like, if I were to say, like, my closest friends in Magic, it's Mason probably...
Oh, sorry, continue. I just want to miss it.
it's Casey, Matt, Manny... Quentin, Michael, probably Danny. And it's like, outside of Manny, Casey's the only one that hasn't just won a PBDQ every season. Manny's just one of my best friends, and it's like, I don't think that most of us have to try. And I don't know the reason. So when we do these, like, how to win a PBDQ episodes, it's kind of hard to explain. Other than saying, once you're good enough, and you need to stop doubting yourself and just play the best Magic you can.
Yeah, I agree with that, but I also think I think you agree with me. So I'm not trying to.
No, I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm trying to figure out, like, how we can be better as a group, because mm-hmm. I think we're rude about it.
Well. I mean, you know, we're having a conversation here about it. I haven't obviously seen this because we live across the country for each other, so we're never at PBDQs.
Well, right.
But if you think you're rude about it, you're probably rude about it. And the best thing to do is be like, Spencer, yeah. Michael, whoever, stop it. Like, you know what I mean? Like, don't act that way. I think that's the best way to do it. And you have to call your friends out on that. And if they're not okay with doing that, you have to decide, are you okay with your friends doing that? And are those the people you want to associate with?
Yeah, I wish that rather than the things that... I do think that we try and help people, so I don't think that that's not true about us. But I wish that we could be better about uplifting the entire community. And I think part of it is, like, part of the... And this is probably true of every Magic community. Part of the Yu-Gi-Oh community is pretty hostile and gross and, like, not actually willing to improve and kind of scummy and salty and...
And they're terrible at Magic and they don't know it and...
And, like, they, like, I mean, I told this story on a Wednesday where I had an opponent that I, like, crushed in the top eight, and I offered a handshake, and he was like, don't ever offer me a handshake when you beat me, and it's like, hey, man, like.
It's funny. MTG Salt's my favorite. It's, I live for Moto screenshots. I don't know. Like, it's so absurd to me, so.
You're alone in that, on this podcast, but what I'm saying is that I'm sure that my friend group could do better. And that's not even saying that we do poorly. I'm sure that none of us have ever been rude to a player trying to win. But behind their backs, I'm sure we're horrible.
Yeah, and I think that's true for a lot of people. I just want you to know that, like, so there are people like Michael Hinderocker are going to be Platinum Pros, and eventually they have to start with the PBDQ scene, right? They got to get up there eventually. And they play a lot of Magic. That's the secret, though, right? Dude.
I wish you understood how good he was at Magic. I wish everybody listened.
I know how good he is. I watched him play at the GP, and I'm just like, yep. Like, everything I thought from watching and talking is
you
like...
Do you feel bad? Like,
no, I'm inspired. I'm like, I want to play against... Oh, that's the thing. When I see someone better than me, it makes me want to get better. Like, when I lose to good players, I get more excited.
Anna Marinaka, local PT Top 8 competitor. My entire goal for a long time was just to crush this guy. Crushed him, like, three out of our last four matches. Just crush the guy. He's like not even close to Michael. Alex Sittner, local drafts, just crushing the dude. Like eight time silver pro. Doesn't matter. Just crush the guy. You know, like all these local guys, like I feel like I have something against. I just don't feel that with Michael, dude. Like he's so good. He's so good. Watching him play Magic sometimes is honestly like watching the greats. It's like, I don't get what you get. I don't see what you see. And our chat is saying right now, I can tell how good Michael is just by hearing him talk. But it's not close. If I were to rank Utah players, it would be like Michael number one.
Skip and then a couple like faces.
Yeah, just skip. And then it's like Alex, Michael, me, Quentin, probably Aaron, and probably Sammy. And then it's Travis, Drew, random people. Like,
rest in peace, Danny.
Did I not say Danny?
You didn't say Danny. I thought you were daggering Danny.
No, I'm not. Okay. Danny's in the Alex, whatever I said with Alex group, he's in that group.
Okay.
But Michael's so much better than everybody else. I hope that people listening to this podcast like appreciate that you are listening to a future Biden bro. Like, I will never be Michael unless I can dedicate the time that Michael can dedicate. Like, it just won't happen. And the thing is that if your goal is to win a PBQ, which is what this episode is about, you don't have to be Michael.
But it can't hurt to play it.
It certainly won't hurt.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, right? It's like, and I kind of put the Facebook poll out there on the group to get a feel of that for this episode. But I made a post in the Constructive Criticism family saying, how many leagues do you play in a week, right? And the range is 0 to 5. 6 to 10.
That's such a big range.
So that's the crazy thing to me, Spencer, is I've already played like 7 leagues this week.
You should be way better at Magic than you are, Mason. I don't know what to tell you.
I'm playing catch up. What do you want from me? I'm trying to catch up.
I don't know what to tell you. Like 0 to 5 leagues is up to 20 hours of Magic, if not more.
All right. So that's the part for me. It's like I play a league in an hour and a half, like consistently. All my VODs are like an hour and a half.
Hold on. Do you think you play your best Magic in that time, though?
I think when I think I'm not streaming, I am. I think I play much better when I'm not streaming. Does that make sense? And I'm still pretty close to that time.
I mean, my win percentage when I stream is, you know, 15% lower than when I don't stream. But I think that the thing that we have to think about here is, like, I think Michael probably plays, like, 15 leagues a week.
15?
Oh, easily.
Oh, yeah, no, I think so, because I get to about 12 to 15. Like, 12 is, like, the average right now. And I'm like,
play 12 leagues a week?
Yeah, for, like, the last 2 weeks. That's been, like, my pretty consistent. Before that, I played 8 to 9 leagues a week. I try and play a league every night, and I try and play... and so here's a question. Because I count when I'm co-piloting a league. Do you count that?
Oh, no, I don't. So if I did that...
Yeah, so that's, like, 3 leagues easy a week.
Okay, yeah, I was going to say the same for me. I probably co-pilot 3 leagues a week and then play 1 to 2 myself. So yeah. I would probably get over the 5 hump had I counted that.
Yeah, I should have put that in the thing, but I didn't.
Okay,
yeah.
I think people would change their answers with it. Well, I think anyway, this is way off topic.
It's a little tangential, but honestly, Spencer, like, it's so, if, like, before I was probably playing 6 leagues, and I've played, because I count Sunday as the beginning of the week, I played 3 leagues on Sunday, I played 2 leagues there, and I co-opted a league. So I guess that's 6. Sorry, I misspoke. So I've done 6 leagues so far.
So, really quick, before we move on, I just want to say that the card of the week this week is Chain Whirler. It wasn't close. We're going to give those out to somebody. It doesn't need to be spoken about. It's the best card in Standard right now. It's actually close.
K-Ron.
So, would that be... K-Ron.
Karn.
Is that true?
I don't know. Karn's
can
so
Chain
good.
Weller be can Chain Weller be redirected to Planeswalkers? I don't know the rules.
I think it can because I saw it get played.
I don't know.
I don't know. I think it was because I saw it at the GP. I'm not sure.
I won't know for probably 2 years what the rules are on any card. But that being said, don't forget to check out patreon.com/ccmtg. Become a patron of the show. The next goal at $500, we will do Pro Tour exclusive episodes. You can hear future Platinum Pro, Michael Hinderacher, talk about his process, his team, things like that. It'll be super amazing. Check it out, patreon.com/ccmtg. We're only like $80 off of that. If we get that in the next couple weeks, you'll get your Pro Tour exclusive episode before that, as well as Pro Tour exclusive episodes for the team grand, the team RBDQ and stuff like that. So check that out, patreon.com/ccmtg. You can find us at Spencer3H on Twitter, at Mason E. Clark, at CCMTG. You can find Michael at MagicMikeMTG. You can join the conversation by joining the Discord. You can just go to the bios page on conservativism.com. Join the clan, message me at Spencer13H or Quentin, that's at Earthstripe, that's URTHSTYRPE. You can join the Facebook group, the Constructivism Family, where you can interact with other listeners of the podcast. If you're a patron of $5 or more, you can join the Constructive Critics group. And you can tweet at us with hashtag WithEverGood. Hashtag WithEverGood is our Twitter outreach program. If you tweet it, Mason will read it as long as he's on the podcast. With that being said,
I'm scrolling. So we did them last week. So
Caroline's is the first.
Yes. At the Mylinguini tweets at Oasis Games when the plug leaked into Daily Conversation, and it's me and Caroline talking. And basically she says, because they were like, what do you listen to now? And then I said, talking about Serial, because we're talking about the Habitat, which is an awesome podcast. And she goes, I keep forgetting to listen to Serial. And I tell her, Oasis Games will never forget your order. So, it's true. It's the truth. They'll never forget your order.
Yeah, Oasis Games is obviously amazing. Caroline is super medium.
Whoa!
She's Spencer's secret favorite, but don't ever let her know that.
What's the friendship status?
Of me and Caroline?
Yeah. Are you good friends? Are you friends? Are you acquaintances? Where are you at?
Caroline can stay at wherever I am staying or living for free anytime she wants.
Is that good friends?
Mason, you literally are paying me $140 to stay with me in Vegas. What does that say about our friendship?
It says that I value your space and I want to pay you because I'm going to take it from you like Caroline. Because we're best friends. All right. I tweet, when Jessica Sinzi tweets, hashtag would that be good? And it's a gif of the Joker saying, come on, hit me. Me and Spencer just started sending like Batman gifs back and forth and making CC jokes about them. And Andrew didn't get it because we make fun of him every time he does hashtag would that be good. And come on, hit me. So,
dude, this thread is complete gas. This might be the best hashtag would that be good thread of all time. There were Bane gifs, Joker gifs, Batman gifs. And here's the thing, Mason, is I was born in podcasting. You get it. You know what I'm saying.
I feel you. All right. Adam Spain tweets, finally trimmed down the collection and going to be able to buy into Modern for the first time since 2012, baby. Hashtag would that be good. What the heck are you buying, Adam?
So here's the thing is this happened to me a couple months ago when Standard rotated. I was like, it was right before Standard rotated. I was like, hey, Quentin, because I share a collection with Quentin. And now Gavin gets access to our account too. I was like, hey, I can just buy Volkit. Like, I can just sell our current standard collection of everything that rotated and buy Volkit. And he's like, I'm in. So we did that. And I think that's a really good way to build a modern collection as you go on MTGO while keeping your standard collection going. And to be fair, just like our other sponsorships, Pure MTGO pays for a lot of my Moto collection. So I'm probably wrong on this, but I did sell an entire standard collection to get into two modern decks.
That's all about that Mana Traders, baby. Hashtag not sponsored.
Yeah, if you put $100 into MTGO every month instead of into Mana Traders, though, you could have every modern deck. Somebody did the math on this. It's like in 1 year.
Right, but here's the difference. I get to play every deck now, and I'm way up in tickets.
You're not up in tickets. Somebody did the math on this, and you actually are down in value because if you win, if your win percentage is 70, which is above average in MTGO and Modern,
mm-hmm.
you would have to be renting specifically Jund every single time, which you actually can't afford on the $100 amount.
Well, I do the $60 amount, but I recently...
There's no chance you're up on tickets then.
But here's the thing. How much do you value the knowledge you get from playing all the decks, constantly able to switch decks, and I don't have to put that cash forward. I get to start just playing whatever deck I want immediately. So I can play basically almost any deck.
But can't you just switch into another deck every month for $100 pretty close to?
So within
3 months, you're in a large portion of Modern, and then within 6 months, you're into almost all of Modern outside of Jund.
That is true, but with standard rotations, and I'm spending $40 more than I am right
now.
No.
I'm saying your standard rotations are free because you already own all of standard like I do.
Okay.
Okay. And then every rotation, you put all of that into Modern.
Okay.
And then every month, you spend $100. You would get into Modern at every deck within 6 months and not have to pay traders. And this was the thing that Quinn and I discussed going into this year. We were like, do we want to pay traders? And was like, already have a Modern deck. We mostly just play Standard because of PBDQs. During Modern season, we can just sell our Standard collection and get into any Modern decks we want.
Yeah.
There's actually... If you are an MTGO grinder, I actually don't believe that Mana Traders is a good solution. I'm actually anti-Mana Traders at this point.
Okay. Well, we'll agree to this. I have had great... But it doesn't matter. We don't have to talk about this on the podcast.
You can play any deck you want, right?
Yeah, I can play any deck I want. And
I can play any Standard deck I want. It's Standard season right now. And then during Modern season, I can sell all of that and play any Modern deck I want. And I retain all of that value.
Mm-hmm. I'm switching up. Part of this is like right now I'm like actually switching between Standard and Modern. Does that make sense too?
Oh yeah. So I can't play any Modern deck I want right now.
Yeah. So I'm testing the Unified Standard. Yeah. And I was testing with PBDQ and I'm helping friends test for the PBDQs. And I'm testing for GP Vegas.
Finally trimmed down on the. Oh, that was the one. Early fitness update, but I just did an 8.5 mile on machine in less than 40 minutes. Up mile 50 minutes 3 weeks ago.
That's awesome. What are you writing about?
He cut 15 minutes off of those miles?
And only 15 minutes? Wait, hang on. Did I misread this? Up from 3 miles in 15 minutes.
He cut 15 minutes off of his 8.5 miles.
In less than 40 minutes. Up from 3 miles in only 15 minutes. No, he's saying before, 3 weeks ago, he was doing... 3 miles in 15 minutes, right?
Oh!
Yeah.
Okay, that's way less insane than I thought what Scotty was saying. With that being said, Scotty did say Chitty Rats and Eldrazi Displacer and Coco have been 2 cards instead of 3-card combo and Coco decks. Also seems good for the Displacer and evenness on demand for Coco's late game with a cord chain has to be good. I don't think so. I would not Chitty Rats anybody.
That's fair. I like Eldrazi Displacer. What do you think about Eldrazi Displacer in humans?
It's a fine one of.
Okay. That's kind of where I'm at. Let's move on to Spencer Hallen tweeting, hashtag MTGDAG, hashtag would that be good. And then he has a video where he has his son's clothes and he talks about how they don't match. And he's like, whatever, the kid's asleep. Put them on. Who cares?
Dude, my wife walked in and she's like, these don't match. And I'm like, so what? Nobody's going to see. Except for the people that watch my video! No, for real. I
didn't know that part of the story.
why we put him in matching pajamas only to change his clothes when he goes to his babysitter.
I don't even know why you'd wear matching clothes like once you're at home, like going to sleep. Who cares? Just wear what you want.
Straight up, I sleep naked, so I don't know.
Hashtag would that be good? Find out next week.
It is...
Spencer tweets, I honestly can't believe how good Breath of the Wild is. I don't have a ton of time to play video games, but every other game doesn't cut it right now because of how good this game is. I haven't even opened Mario from my Switch yet. Hashtag would that be good. First off, not playing Mario. Not hashtag would that be good. That's bad. Mario's great. But I understand because Breath of the Wild is so good. It's insane.
I never thought I would say this.
Alright.
Breath of the Wild is the best video game of all time.
Hmm. It's really, really good.
Dude, I don't even have words. I don't even know how many hours I am into this game. And I don't care. And the last time I felt this way was Mass Effect and KOTOR.
Like, yeah, Mass Effect 2 is really good.
Morrowind might have been this good. Like, it's on that level of video game. Where it's like, I don't care how long I'm playing this. Like, this is fun. This is fun from start to finish. And I'm not close to finishing it.
Have you found the little island where you can only get there by hitting the fan and then you lose all your items?
Yes.
That place was awesome. That's such a weird, cool thing to put in a video game. I love it.
Dude, the whole game is like... this is super spike feed, but like... I don't know when I will finish this game. But I will continue playing it for as long as... until I beat it. And I'm sure I'll beat it with like 300 hours left. Like... the game is insane.
Yeah, I haven't beat it yet either, but it's really good.
You haven't beat it? That's like insane!
Yeah.
Are you still having fun with it?
I'm still having... so I do this thing where like I'll play it for like 8 or 9 hours straight, yeah, and I'll stop for like 2 weeks, and I'll do it again.
Dude.
So that's kind of like where I'm at with it.
Here's the other thing. Have you ever played a better mobile game? It's not even close.
The only close one's Hearthstone. That's just because I love card games.
Oh, dude, the only close one to me was Final Fantasy Tactics Advanced. Like,
I think I put it on the phone.
The only game that comes close is Final Fantasy Tactics Advanced. And it's because it fit on your Game Boy SP so well. And the Game Boy SP, by the way, probably the best mobile system outside of the Switch, depending on how the Switch evolves.
Yeah.
But I don't actually have words for how good. It's funny, because if you asked me literally a week ago yesterday, or tomorrow... so last Wednesday, I said Breath of the Wild is the second best video game of all time behind KOTOR. And today I'm prepared to say that Breath of the Wild is actually just the best video game ever. And that eliminates my Star Wars bias. Like, Star Wars is my favorite thing in the world. KOTOR is my favorite video game of all time. But it's not as good as Breath of the Wild. It's not. The only downside of Breath of the Wild is the weapon system. It's stupid. I don't know why they did it.
I kind of like it.
You're
gonna be scrappy. And also it's like the hoarder in me where it's like, I don't want to use my best sword.
It's so stupid. I use my worst weapons all the time because I don't want to use my good ones. And then when you get to use it,
you feel so powerful.
Do you though? Because I never use them. Anyway.
Oh, I use them eventually. I'll get mad at the boss and I'll kill it.
Spencer 3 and H, editing how to win a PPTQ cast together without the time sensitive portions has to be good. Ask Mason. That's his job now.
I thought he was saying he was going to do it. I was going to say that's awesome. But that'd be an awesome Patreon only thing that maybe I'll have time for soon. And then maybe if you're a patron, you'll see that pop up on the website soon. It'd be pretty sweet.
Yeah. I can make that a Patreon only goal to have like training part segments together. I can make that a goal.
Yeah, I can just add
Gronk, whatever. Gronk licensed Monster Energy. Spencer 13H has said that'd be good.
What's a Gronk?
So Gronk is the best tight end of all time, and it's not close. But he's also always injured, so he's a Patriots tight end. He has two Super Bowl rings, one without him and one with him, so he's injured during one of them. So here's the thing. Gronk's insane. I don't know what this tastes like, so I can't give an opinion. But... I think this is Gronk and Brady's last year. So if they don't win the Super Bowl this year, I don't know how Gronk energy will last. I don't know. I don't know what's going on.
Do you like energy drinks?
Are you serious?
I don't drink them at all.
So the orange, so Rockstar Recovery, the orange, the fruit juice, and the lemonade are the only energy drinks I drink anymore outside of Red Bull, sugar-free Red Bulls for Red Bull vodkas, because I love vodka. There's probably a 0% chance to get me to drink this drink. So here's the thing. Is Rockstar Recovery is basically like Powerade with caffeine and garnine. Okay. What is it called? Carotene?
I'm not exactly sure. But
carotene? I don't know what they're called. It's something like that. So basically, it's just Powerade with the energy supplements. I don't drink any other energy drink anymore. And the reason for this is because when I was working at Oasis Games, I was having about 8 Red Bulls a day.
Wow.
And I was having heart palpitations, and I went to the doctor, and they did a CAT scan on me. Or not a CAT. No. What's the one that they do for pregnancy where they, like, put jelly on your belly? Nope. That's a vagina thing.
Oh, my bad. Always on my mind. I'm not sure.
I also just said vagina on the podcast.
It's all right.
No. It's a gosh darn it. They, like, put a jelly on your stomach, and then they... Ultrasound. It's an ultrasound.
So
they
did an ultrasound
on me, and it's fine. I'm the one that has a kid. I'm the one that's an idiot for not remembering this. And they found sludge in my stomach from drinking energy drinks. So I completely went off of carbonation, energy drinks, and all that for a while until I had a kid, and then I just needed the energy. You're laughing. It's not.
No, it's funny because it's true. Like, you need to keep going.
It was rough. So I now only drink the recovery drinks, and they're basically just Powerade with energy. And I drink about one and a half a day.
I Powerade. Send that sponsor money over here. Let go.
Oh man, Powerade has all the money. So thank you everybody for listening. Thank you so much. We'll see you guys all next week. Mason, what did you learn this week?
I learned that we both have a hard time thinking of something that's very basic sometimes.
Ultrasound? Yeah.
Ultrasound. I honestly forgot, and I was trying to think of it as I bought time saying that. And it was also good just to, like, hear, you know, because I kind of knew where you stood on it because I had listened to the podcast before, but you and I had never really had that kind of conversation one-on-one. So it was good to have that conversation and see that I'm not crazy.
Yeah. For me, it's something I need to learn is, like, I obviously surround myself with players that qualify for the Pro Tour. And I don't think our listeners have that luxury. And one of the things that I need to learn is, like, how to communicate with players that can't do that. Cuz I mean, even in Nashville, you have one player that qualifies for most Pro Tours.
Basically. We have Hess.
I've looked at your Planeswalker points and your Pro points, and Utah's abnormal. We have 6 players that have qualified for Pro Tours in the last 3 years. Maybe more. 7? Yeah, it's a lot of players. And in other locations, it's significantly less. So I don't know what makes Utah different. I don't know if it's the...
It's the Oasis Games.
It is the greatest little way. It's also significantly more PBTQs. We have, because we're in Utah, we have a very large number of game stores. And because of that, it's very easy to win a PBTQ because there's so many. But I don't know how to quantify that and give it back to the listener. So thank you everybody for listening. We'll figure that out, and we'll see you guys all next week.